group of our guests, the governor, her entourage, and 24 other officials, have all been transported to the surface, and the mass evacuation will be underway within the next few hours. Across all our ships, our relocation specialists are making their way down the decks, answering questions, alleviating fears, offering help. While this voyage has not been without its trials, we have learned a great deal about how to manage the expectations and concerns of our guests, and the news of the revised figures for the blast range necessitated a thorough reappraisal of our resources, I am cautiously satisfied with how the mission has progressed so far. We have brought nearly 10,000 souls to safety, away from the imminent destruction of their world, to a place where they can begin a new life, in peace. The sight of these refugees will remain with me for a very long time. We cannot, in truth, compensate for the loss of one's home, the exile from a beloved place to which it is impossible to return. And while we cannot make these partings anything other than bittersweet, we can try to make the transition to a new way of life as painless as we possibly can. Verity. The evacuation process had been underway for 21 hours when Picard received a message from Sub-Praetor Suvim requesting an urgent meeting. Suvim had continued to be a thorn in his side throughout the voyage, but Picard had found that treating him with courtesy had gone a considerable way to mollifying him. Raffi had remarked on his forbearance on numerous occasions. "I try to remember, Raffi," he said, "how I would feel, torn from my home, cast adrift." Suvim was a man of authority, a man who commanded considerable respect. At the end of his life, when he should be resting on his laurels, his world has shrunk to the size of a small cabin, granted to him by the charity of his enemies.
"Huh," said Raffi. "Quite a large cabin, but I get your point."
Besides, whenever Picard reached his limits, he was able to send Coley Jokan to Suvim to listen to tales of his glory days. He brought Coley with him this time. "Who knows," said Picard as they stood in the turbolift. "Perhaps Suvim wants to thank us for his comfortable journey and the excellent conversation you have provided." He glanced at the young woman. "You have been a great help, Jokan. I am grateful."
"You won't believe this, Admiral, but he has been very interesting to talk to. He lost his wife some years back. I think he's lonely."
"I'm grateful nonetheless. He is a changed man." Arriving at Suvim's quarters, however, they could see that all was not well. Suvim, glancing up and down the corridor, hurried them inside. What was he concerned about? Could he still believe that he was not safe here on a Starfleet vessel after all these weeks? As soon as they were inside his cabin, Suvim hastened them over to the computer.
"I have something to show you," he said. "This is footage from the surface of Arnath. Please, Admiral, look closely."
Picard leaned in. The images were fuzzy, disjointed, and angled from low down, as if someone was recording using a concealed device held close to their side. Nevertheless, it was quickly clear what was going on. High fences, tents, dust. Picard frowned. Still,
"I am not unaware of the irony," said Suvim, "that I am complaining about accommodation yet again. And I know that these images are not clear, but I have had other messages from the ground, from people begging me to help them. They tell me that they are being held prisoners, that they are living in the dirt, that they are not sure there is enough food or water."
His voice was becoming desperate. This was a war veteran, Picard thought, someone who had been courageous and bold, to be pleading with his enemies for help. Suvim, glimpsing the pity in Picard's eyes, began to change his tone.
"It is unacceptable. We were promised homes, schools, hospitals. I will not have it."
"Sub-Praetor," Picard said calmly, "let me speak to the authorities on the ground. They might permit a brief visit from Starfleet." It was a little easier said than done, Picard thought as he stared at the comm screen in his ready room, but the trick was not to be the one to blink first. Commander Tholoth, said Picard to the stern-faced young Romulan who was flatly denying his request to take a small team down to Arnath. I understand that this is a Romulan world, and that these are Romulan citizens. Nevertheless, they have been our guests for some time, and we should like to see them settled comfortably.
Why should they not be comfortable?
I would ask you to consider whether you would like to facilitate this visit, or whether I should speak directly to your ambassador to the Federation. But may I suggest to you, Commander, that it is never good for an officer's career if their name first comes to the attention of their superiors as a participant in a diplomatic incident.
The screen went dead. Picard waited. Raffi, sitting across from him, lifted an eyebrow. The comm chimed. A message from the ground granting permission for 2 Starfleet visitors to come to the planet's surface. Picard smiled. The gambit had paid off. Raffi whistled.
I didn't think you were going to pull that one off, J.R.
He was a young man, said Picard. All I had to do was pull rank.
Resettlement Facility 124, Arnath.
Raffi fussed a little about allowing him down on the surface, but he insisted, taking Coley with him, and found, to his dismay, that Suvim was not exaggerating. The outlook on Arnath was bleak. Within seconds of their arrival, both he and Coley were coughing from the red dust, screwing up their eyes, which were quickly running from the grit in the air. The overwhelming impression was of barrenness. A dry world lacking life, lacking the conditions that would permit life to flourish. Picard, surveying the dismal scene, murmured, What has happened here? He was looking at a fence, a high fence, and beyond that all he could see were rows upon rows of tents. In the narrow gaps between them, soldiers, armored, helmeted, visored, were patrolling in pairs, kicking up red dust as they passed. More pairs stood at the intersections between the tents, disruptors at the ready. As for the people, they were barely visible. He saw a face here and there, peering out from under a tent flap, disappearing rapidly back inside as a patrol went past. Coley, too, was looking around in horror.
This isn't what I expected.
No, said Picard sternly. Not in the slightest.
Picard pondered briefly what his expectations had been. The impression they had been given from the Romulans was that work had been underway for some time on Arnath to receive settlers. He had not expected a fully built town that would take a while and require local resources, but he had at the very least expected structures. Houses, not pens. On Cardassia, he recalled, after the Jem'Hadar destroyed the infrastructure, the relief mission had used industrial replicators and large-scale archiprinters to rapidly produce modular buildings, homes of various sizes according to need, medical centers, schools, recreation facilities. Even the headquarters of the relief effort had used them as its building blocks. They had not been beautiful, but there had been a spare functionality and orderliness about them that inspired calm, or a sense that everything was under control. There was none of this here. There was order, yes, but it was the order brought by the threat of force. There was the order commanded by fear. Tapping his comm badge, he said, Raffi, get me images of the area around here. He heard footsteps crunching behind him and turned to see a Romulan officer followed by 2 armed guards.
Admiral Picard, said the officer. My name is Talak. I am the commander of this facility.
Facility? Said Picard. We were expecting a town.
Talak, cut short, gave him a cold look.
Whatever we call it is our business. Can I ask why you're here? Tholoth insisted I allow this visit, but I could not see any reason why.
I'm here to ensure that our guests have arrived safely.
Once they leave your ships, they are no longer your responsibility.
And while that might be technically correct, thought Picard, in the narrowest legalistic sense, it was certainly not in any way morally correct.
I disagree.
Beside him, he was aware of Coley shifting uneasily. "We are grateful for your help, Picard," said Tilak. "But these are Romulans. We'll take care of them. Go now." Picard looked beyond the fence and then back at the implacable officer in front of him. This was not, he sensed, somebody who could be manipulated into standing down. He tapped his comm badge. "Verity," he said. "2 to beam up." The dust and misery of Arnath disappeared, and he and Coley were back on their sleek, safe ship. "Raffi," said Picard, "have you got me those images yet?" Daystrom Institute, Okinawa, Earth. A couple of months into Estella McKenzie's assignment to the Daystrom Institute, Maddox was grudgingly admitting that the gruff engineer knew her stuff. Still, bioneural circuitry, it was hardly the work he had dreamed of doing. More than ever, he was glad that Agnes Girati was around, someone he could talk to, who knew what this work was costing him. Someone who understood his frustrations and regrets. They had taken to meeting away from the campus. They wanted privacy. They would choose a city in turn where they were unknown, anonymous faces in the crowd. He had made her go hiking in New Zealand, where she had been woefully underprepared and got blisters within half an hour. She had gotten her revenge by dragging him to the carnival in Venice, making him dress up and dance. She chose a mask for him with a long beak, while she wore something encrusted with red beads and crowned in feathers. He had doubled down with Machu Picchu. More damn hills. And she had responded with a show in Las Vegas. But now they were sitting in the campus coffee house. He was drawing a picture on a napkin, explaining, after she had asked, about the latest upgrade in the circuitry and the problems they were having making it interface with the casings that they had designed to house the circuitry. The bodies, he supposed he should think of them. "So damn frustrating," he said. "The circuitry is solid, I'm sure. Complex enough for the task at hand. But if we can't get it to work within the casing, then it's no better than a brain in a jar. I feel like I'm missing something obvious." He realized that she had stopped responding some time ago. When he looked up from his notes, he saw an image of dejection. She was sitting, shoulders slumped, looking down at her uneaten cake. "Aggie, what's the matter?" She shrugged. "Tired?"
"No. Yes. It's difficult."
"Okay." He started folding the napkin. They sat for a while in silence.
"My time's up the end of next week," she said after a while.
"Oh," he said.
"It's been nice, hasn't it?"
"Very nice." He started twisting the napkin around his fingers like a ring.
"It's been great watching you work," she said. "I know you're not keen on the project, but it's been a thrill to see the new facility set up."
"Yeah, the space is amazing, isn't it?"
He gave a slightly bitter laugh.
"A dream come true. Astonishing the resources that Starfleet can find when they have to."
"It's good work," she said, her voice high and false.
"I guess."
He began to shred the napkin. She put her hand on his to stop him. They looked straight at each other.
"Aggie," he said urgently, "I know you were only here to take a few classes, but why don't you stay?"
She stared back. "What do you mean?"
"I mean, there's nobody here who understands what it's like. What it means to move my focus away from my own research and have to work instead on this."
"Do you want me to work with you on the non-synthetics?"
"You should be doing doctoral work, Agnes," he said.
"I'm already a doctor," she said brightly. "MD."
"You know what I mean. You're smart. So very smart. Come and work on this. Get the doctorate in robotics. You'll race through it. I've read your dissertation. You know it's going to get one of the highest grades we've given out for a master's."
"Are you supposed to be telling me that?"
"With that behind you, you can work on whatever you like. Work alongside someone else."
"Work with you, you mean?"
"Well," he laughed,
I've got this whole new facility.
Making toys, she said.
There is that.
He chewed his lip. He knew somehow that if she was here, then at least some of the dream would remain alive. He knew somehow that she was a necessary part of his dream, that without her, he would not be able to continue. What he did not know was how to tell her all this.
But if you'd rather go back and practice medicine, I'd understand.
He looked back at her, almost afraid to see what was there. But her eyes were shining. Bruce, she said, it's what I wanted. Of course I'll stay. Verity. Picard, Raffi, and Coley gathered in his ready room to study the images from the surface of Arnaf. The facility was easy to see. It stretched out for miles, row after row of tents set in the middle of nowhere. They could see little in the way of infrastructure. They could see a great deal in the way of fences, guards, and towers.
Facility, said Picard and shook his head. It's a prison. Tents in a desert. There's nothing there.
What do you think happened? Said Raffi. Did they run out of time? Is this temporary? Resources stretched too thin, said Coley. They made promises to get these people to leave their homes, and then they weren't able to deliver. Suvim? Nenema? These are pretty high-ranking people, said Raffi. If the Romulan government isn't able to supply homes and facilities for them, what's it going to be like for the people without their influence? They're not that influential, said Coley. Not in the great scheme of things. They're provincial officials. Perhaps they were causing too much noise, so they were sent on their way so quickly. Send them off. Shut them up.
But if they couldn't build what they'd promised, said Picard, why didn't they simply ask for help? We have industrial replicators, large-scale printers, all ready for use.
Secrecy, said Raffi. It's the Romulan way.
Let's make the offer to Commander Talak, at least, said Picard. Although how it will be received.
Nothing ventured. Raffi asked Marshall to open a channel to Commander Talak.
What's your advice, Jokan? Picard said. How do we help?
She sighed. The problem is, I don't think we can.
But you saw that camp, said Picard. I cannot, in good conscience, allow the people we have brought here to be left in conditions such as that.
What do you propose to do, Admiral?
Summon Talak here and ask him to explain himself.
Why would Talak come?
Because...
Picard stopped. There was, of course, no reason for Talak to come, and no way to compel him. You see the difficulty? Said Coley. This is an internal Romulan affair. We have brought them here at the request of the Romulan Senate, but it's exactly as Talak said. Once they have left our ships, they are no longer our responsibility. Raffi's comm badge chirped, and she tapped it and jumped right in. Commander Talak, Admiral Picard would like to discuss the possibility of supplying you with industrial replicators.
Commander Musiker, this is a Romulan matter. We will handle this. You will continue transporting all Romulan citizens down to Arnath.
The channel snapped shut. Before Picard could reopen it, his comm badge sounded.
Picard!
Lieutenant Marshall cut in. It's Subprator Suvim, sir. He's refusing to leave the ship. There's 200 of them who say they won't go. Well, said Raffi, now it's getting interesting.
This is not what we were promised, said Suvim. This is not why we left our homes. I understand, said Picard. Although I am at a loss to know what I can do to help, Subprator. I have very limited authority here. Take us away, said Suvim. Take us somewhere else.
Picard rubbed his cheek. He had suggested this to Talak. He had made many suggestions to Talak over the last few hours, but the only response had been the commander's expectation that the transportation of Romulan citizens under his care would continue, and on completion of this task, the Starfleet vessels would leave local space. After a while,
Even this response had stopped. What solution was there?
I'm unsure such a location exists, Suvim, said Picard. Commander Tilak is very clear that this is where you should disembark. He says that these are temporary accommodations.
Suvim snorted.
No, he didn't believe that either, although Picard was surprised that he was prepared to voice the opinion so openly.
Picard opened his mouth to offer further assurances, and then he took another look at the old veteran. This wasn't good enough, he thought. This was not a just reward for this man's life and service.
Subpraetor Suvim, he said, you are perfectly correct that this is not an acceptable solution. Let me speak to my superiors. I shall do everything in my power to help.
Institute of Astronomy, Cambridge, Earth. On the day of the symposium, the two Romulans arrived precisely 3 minutes before the session, bypassed the conversation in the hall, and went straight into the seminar room. Safadi, following Haig, stood at the door and watched as they chose where to sit. The seating was arranged in a horseshoe shape, 3 banked levels, with the speaker standing between the points of the horseshoe. The exit, there was only one, was to the right of the speaker, near one end of the rows of seats.
Let's see what they make of this, said Haig, mildly amused. They'll want to be able to study the speakers and their presentations closely, but they'll also want to be close to the exit.
They could split up, said Safadi.
Oh, no, Haig said. If one of them is a real scientist, the other is their Tal Shiar handler, and we'll want to stay at the scientist's side. If they're both Tal Shiar, they'll want to work as a unit.
And if they're both real scientists?
That was never going to happen, Haig said.
Cheerfully, he added,
Of course, knowing the Romulans, it's possible they don't even know what the other one is. Tal Shiar watching Tal Shiar.
That's madness, said Safadi.
It's certainly not an efficient use of resources, said Haig. And yet they are the most effective secret police in 2 quadrants. Only the Obsidian Order compared, and they don't exist any longer. It's almost as if extreme paranoia isn't a viable survival strategy.
He eyed her.
What do you think?
Don't ask me, she said. I'm an astronomer, not a sociologist.
Eventually, their Romulan guests chose seats at the end of the back row near the door. If they hoped to be unobtrusive, it didn't pay off. Everyone who came in had to walk past them to take a seat, taking a good long look as they went past.
I hope they are, Tal Shiar, said Haig with barely suppressed glee. They must be hating this.
No, no, chided Safadi. That isn't in the spirit of scientific collaboration.
Haig took his seat at the other side of the room in the back row, directly facing the 2 Romulans. Once he was sitting, he gave them a cheery salute, professional spy to professional spy. Safadi took her place at the front of the room, checked that the mic, the visual tagging for sign users, and the universal translators were all working fine. She opened the symposium. The morning went quickly, fascinatingly, informatively. Safadi, sitting at the end of the front row so that she was on hand to help any speaker struggling with the equipment, also had a good view of the 2 Romulans. One was entirely focused on the presentations. The other took more interest in the room. Safadi watched as one by one he studied each attendee. Every so often his lips moved silently. She guessed he was sub-vocalizing, somehow recording his impressions. Had Haig done a sweep for that kind of technology? Or had he simply decided that he would let them get away with it? They were all at universities and research institutes, Safadi thought. You could look up their resumes. She turned back to the proceedings. This mindset, she thought. You could lose yourself in a vast maze. Pathways and alleyways turning back on themselves, dead ends, false entrances and exits. It was nonsense. At the break for lunch, and at Haig's request, Safadi made her way straight to the two Romulans, who stood uneasily on one side of the room, holding plates and staring straight ahead.
"Hi," she said. "Welcome to Cambridge. We're glad to have you here."
Up close, they were younger than she had expected, and certainly young enough to convince as graduate students. They made eye contact briefly and looked back down at their food.
"I was wondering whether you'd had a chance to discuss the program with Dr. Vitet, whether he had any thoughts. I was hoping to send him my paper beforehand, get a response from him, but..."
One of them, the slightly older one, said, "Dr. Vitet sends apologies for his absence." And that was as far as she got with either of them. After a few more minutes of vague and opaque exchanges, she had to return to the hall to get ready for her own presentation. Haig, passing her by on his way to his seat, said,
"Anything?"
"Nothing," she said. "I'm not even sure that they know who Vitet is."
And then it was time for her to speak, to put her figures out there and live with the consequences. Throughout her presentation, she was conscious of both Romulans taking assiduous notes as she explained her figures. As she came to the end of the explanation of her calculations and began to summarize some of the ramifications, she knew that the room was completely silent, everyone's eye on her. She saw one or two people watching her, but writing at the same time on pads, uploading her presentation in real time for two quadrants to read. The message was getting out there. The progress of the supernova was moving faster, and its effects would hit harder than anyone had predicted. She heard blips and chimes on people's various devices as responses started coming back. She tried to put this all aside and focus on delivering the research. When she was done, she stopped and looked back at the formulae on the display screen behind her.
"Well," she thought, "it's all out there now." "That's the math," she said. "I guess it's over to Starfleet."
There was a brief silence, and the room exploded into applause. Hands were shooting up around the room. She looked around and saw the two Romulans stand up and leave. She never saw them again. She took the questions, and then the room pored over her figures, examined them, asked questions about them, concluded en masse that she was accurate. After that, and a few closing remarks, people began to make their way back to the transporters for their journeys home. Haig, on his way out, said,
"Good work, Dr. Safadi. I'll be in touch."
The day was over. Safadi chatted for a while to a couple of the postdocs, and then took one last look around the lecture room. Cups and plates and remains of people's lunch were still strewn about, giving the room a forlorn feeling. She had that sense of deflation that always came after a presentation, the sense that something special and important had happened, but was now finished and would never return.
"I'm tired," she thought. "Time to go home."
She went back first to her office to leave her notes on her desk. She wouldn't work on them again today. But before she left, she opened her computer and wrote a message.
"Dear Dr. Vitet, a short note to let you know that the symposium today went well, although your presence and expertise were greatly missed. May I compliment you, however, on your students who asked such penetrating questions. They are a credit to you. I am sending you my paper. I hope it is of interest. I would welcome any thoughts that you might have. These are difficult days for you and your people, and while I am sad that you could not join us, I hope you know that you have an open invitation to visit us here at the Institute at any time. Above all, we are scientists, and that work, while it might not transcend other ties, nonetheless connects us all in a very special and particular way. I remain your colleague, and hope one day to be your friend. Dr. Amol Safadi, Institute of Astronomy, the University of Cambridge, Earth." She read the message over and then sent it. If she had taken advice from Haig, from anyone with any expertise on Romulan affairs, she might have thought twice.
she might have thought what this letter looked like read through the ever-watchful eyes of the Tal Shiar. She might have thought twice before holding out the hand of friendship. Daystrom Institute, Okinawa, Earth. Agnes Girotti's paperwork had come through, and she was now officially a doctoral student at the Daystrom Institute under the supervision of the chair of robotics, Professor Bruce Maddox. They went to Istanbul to celebrate. Staring at the mosaics in Hagia Sophia, he started burbling suddenly about when he came here as a kid with his mother, who was mad about Byzantine art, only he wasn't. Kids are never interested in what their parents do, and that was one reason he had never wanted kids. But then, she had shoved a poem by Yeats in front of him, and he had read about enameling and hammered gold and clockwork birds and bodily forms and natural things, and he realized then what it was he wanted to do. Make life. Make something so beautiful it would keep an emperor awake. Aggie stood and listened to every word, her mouth open, her eyes bright. That night, he went back to the lab. All was quiet. He wandered around the new big room, kitted out with everything Starfleet could throw at him. The lights were down. At the far end was the tall chamber containing the parts of the prototype that he and Mackenzie had been laboring over. The creature stood motionless in shadow. He stared with faint loathing at its immobile features. The skin was golden. They had not bettered the materials used on Data. But what lay within was a pale shadow. "Are you ever going to wake up?" Maddox said. "Are you ever going to set me free?" He pulled out a pad and a stylus. He started to doodle, his head still full of the mosaics. And then he saw it. The solution. The way to bridge the gap between Mackenzie's circuitry and the casings he had so grudgingly designed. He turned to the nearest computer and began to program. Ideas were flooding through his mind, each one opening out onto a new one, like the fractals of a Mandelbrot set. He keyed in some words, deleted them, laughed, and keyed in some more. Behind him, something stirred. And then came a small voice, as rusty as a tin man caught in the rain.
"Daisy, Daisy, give me your answer, do."
Maddox turned to look at his creation. "Hello," he said. "I guess you're my red-headed stepchild." Verity. In orbit over Arnath. Picard spoke directly to both Bordson and Clancy. The CNC, despite his obvious sympathy, was implacable.
"I'm sorry, Jean-Luc, but Commander Tillac is correct. These are Romulan citizens. They are under his jurisdiction."
"They are still on board the Verity."
"Then they must be persuaded to leave."
This was all very well for the CNC to say, thought Picard. But he had not met Suvim.
"The reality is that I have several hundred terrified refugees who have nothing to lose."
He thought again about what he had seen on Arnath.
"Victor, if you could see the conditions down there. It is desperate. People were promised homes, a place to resettle and start their lives once again. Facilities such as these. I cannot even call them facilities. This is a camp. We cannot be a part of that. We should speak out in the strongest terms, not allow this to go ahead."
"The President has spoken directly to the Romulan Praetor," said Bordson. "We've expressed our disquiet. We've made offer after offer. And we've been told these are their citizens, and they will care for them."
Clancy added, "The timing's unfortunate. Safadi's research hit the public comms yesterday. The Romulans are furious, calling it bad faith. They're muttering about cutting back our involvement entirely. Perhaps before that, we might have been able to persuade Telak's superiors to allow us to help set up new facilities at least. But we've been shut down. They've been embarrassed publicly.
They want to resolve this on their own terms.
Victor, said Picard, these people are refusing to leave my ship, and I sympathize entirely with their plight.
They have to leave, said Bordson. It's as simple as that.
I assume, said Picard rather coldly, that you are not authorizing the use of force.
There was silence, and he wondered for a moment whether he had overstepped the mark.
I am by no means authorizing the use of force to transport refugees into the camps, said Bordson.
I understand that you are under a great deal of pressure, but when you're ready, I'll accept your apology for that.
Sir, I apologize unreservedly.
Good. Bordson looked at him sympathetically. We are all struggling with the ramifications of this mission. We support you entirely. It seems to me, said Clancy, that we have two options. Picard noted and appreciated the we. We transport these people directly to the surface, or we permit the Romulans to transport them.
One of those options seems like cowardice, Captain, Picard said. Can we at least continue to press our offer of material aid?
We can press, said Clancy. I am pressing, but they are not buying what we're offering.
I'm sorry, Jean-Luc, said Bordson, but if this is what it takes for us to continue the mission, then this is what we need to do.
Understood. Picard out.
He cut the comm and looked over at Raffi, who had been sitting and listening.
One bite at a time, eh, Raffi?
You know what, J.L.? Turns out some things are hard to swallow. Picard spoke to Suvim privately and face to face. He thought the man might rage, complain, refuse. But as he spoke, as he explained the situation in full, the impossibility of it all, the limits on his ability to act, he watched the sub-praetor crumble. The Romulan seemed to age. It was terrible to behold. Picard thought, this is the death of hope. He never wanted to see this again, a man brought so low. In the end, Suvim and the others went quietly to the transporter rooms. They stood clutching their possessions and their dignity. Picard stood quietly by as a witness. Before the transporter took him, Suvim looked at Picard and said,
"Javantar, Jean-Luc Picard, I curse you. You, this ship, this fleet, this mission. May you taste ash. May the fruits of your labors wither on the vine. I curse you, Starfleet, and the Federation, who offer the hand of friendship only to snatch it away."
And then he was gone. Picard felt Raffi's hand upon his shoulder, the briefest of touches. He was glad, very glad, that she was there.
"Well, Raffi," he said, without turning to look at her, "have we heard back from Talak as to whether we might place independent observers on Arnath?"
"Oh, yes, we've heard, J.L.," she said.
"I assume he said no."
"He said no." Picard cleared his throat, tugged at his uniform jacket. Coley, at his other side, said, "I know this is hard, Admiral. It is never easy. But we have done the right thing. We have no legal jurisdiction to intervene in Romulan domestic affairs."
"Ah, yes," he thought. "We retain our moral purity."
"Yet you know, don't you," said Raffi, "that there'll be abuses of power down there. The first sign of trouble, those soldiers will shoot." Picard's comm badge chimed. He tapped it, and Marshall spoke.
"All of our guests are down on Arnath, sir. The facility has now been cloaked."
"Thank you, Lieutenant," said Picard.
He looked at Raffi and Coley.
"We're finished here. We should move on."
Raffi fell into step alongside him as they walked down the corridor. He felt the subtle shift of the ship's impulse engines.
10,000 down, Raffi muttered. That's nearly a billion, huh?
Verity. After Arnath,
The Admiral's black mood hovered over the whole ship and threatened to engulf the entire fleet. Rafi was caught out by this aspect of the man. He seemed to move through life on a higher plane, she thought. Calm, measured, sometimes driven to exasperation, but always seeming to be in possession of some deeper, wider sight that gave him perspective. To find him brought low, it surprised her. Ever practical, she knew this was something that had to be managed, and that this was her task. She made a point in her daily updates to highlight successes. The addition of another 3 refitted ships, the successful transfer of 5,000 people to a newly built garden city on a small conservation world, and the grateful messages sent by their children. The distraction was good for her, too, keeping her from brooding over her increasingly chilly conversations with Jay. She had begun in recent weeks to notice that Gabe was adopting more and more of his mannerisms, his ways of speaking. She remembered her son when he was tiny, when he had still seemed an extension of her. She dreamed sometimes of putting him in a little boat, watching the boat drift away. She was here, and she had her duty. She conferred with Coley, whom she had begun to confide in more and more. Coley advised patience. Later that week, she issued an invitation for the Admiral and Rafi to join her in her quarters. When Coley let them in, they found that her cabin was lit only by candles.
Peldor Joy, she said to them.
Picard smiled for the first time in weeks.
Peldor Joy, Coley Jokan.
He turned to Rafi.
The Bajoran Festival of Gratitude. Come, Jokan. Let us say farewell to our troubles.
Coley explained the ritual to Rafi. Write your worries on renewal scrolls. Burn them in the fire. Picard wrote at once. Rafi thought for a while, then wrote, Losing my boy. They consigned their troubles to the flames. Peldor Joy, they said to one another.
Thank you, Jokan, said Picard after they had eaten together, for sharing this with us.
The ritual had the desired cleansing effect, lifting the Admiral's mood, although he did remain subdued. Without more ships, without news from the Daystrom Institute or from Mars, they were still limited in what they could do. Eat a herd of damn elephants, with 50 more arriving each day. A few weeks later, Rafi joined Picard in his ready room as he was speaking to the captain of one of the other ships. Seeing Rafi, he indicated that she should come in and sit down. He twisted the screen so that she could see Captain Zotus on board the USS Dignity.
The Dignity is at Sithu, he said. Almost the whole population is now on board.
Rafi nodded. The original intention had been to take the inhabitants of Sithu to Lukol 2. That now fell within the revised blast range and would need its own evacuation plan.
I'm glad to report we have a solution, said Zotus. Of sorts.
We've had an offer from a small colony world, explained Picard. They're able to accept a limited Romulan population.
What's the catch? Said Rafi.
It's a human colony on Tarrasa, said Zotus. That's just outside the neutral zone. In Federation space.
Ah, said Rafi. So not a solution.
Oh, I rather think it is, said Picard.
Rafi, shooting him a quick look, saw that his mood had lifted. He was poised, eager, ready once more to act.
Captain Zotus, when your guests are all on board, you should proceed with all speed to Tarrasa.
Are you sure, Admiral?
Those are my orders, Captain Zotus. I'm quite sure. Picard out.
He stood up and moved from behind his desk. At the door, he halted and looked back at her.
What is it, Rafi?
I didn't say anything.
You don't approve.
Rafi folded her arms.
I wholly approve of saving as many lives as possible.
His mouth quirked into a smile.
Good.
He walked out onto the bridge to take his chair. Rafi, on her way to her own seat, passed Coley.
Jokan, she said as she walked past.
Remember that thing I said would never happen?
It's happening. Rafi took her seat beside the admiral. He was already issuing his instructions.
Lieutenant Miller, he said, set in a course for the neutral zone.
A murmur, quickly suppressed, passed over the bridge, although Miller, to his credit, did not even blink. Rafi leaned over to Picard.
J.L., she said softly. Quick question.
Yes, Rafi.
Are you quite sure you don't need to ask for permission to dismantle the neutral zone?
The admiral shrugged. He had never seemed so French.
Better to ask forgiveness than permission, Rafi.
I'll look forward to using that on you one day, she said.
I'd be disappointed if you didn't.
He leaned forward in his chair.
Engage.
Daystrom Institute, Okinawa, Earth. It was the last day of the old year. Bruce Maddox, watching his audience of two, said, in the manner of a showman about to perform an illusion, "Prepare to be amazed." Mackenzie leaned forward, excited. LaForge folded his arms and looked as if he had come a long way not to be impressed. Maddox opened the door beside him and said, "Come on out." There was movement behind the door. Then a figure walked through, slowly but steadily and smoothly. Mackenzie gasped. LaForge said, "Well, I'll be damned."
"Allow me to introduce the Daystrom A-500, said Maddox.
He looked at the face of his creation and felt repulsed. Gold pseudo-flesh, too reminiscent of Data, but the most reliable thermoplastic they had found for the casing. It would endure. Golden eyes that blinked too regularly, too carefully. But these creatures were not aiming for verisimilitude. They did not need to pass for human. They simply needed to function.
"Damn, Bruce," said Mackenzie. There were tears in her eyes. "You've done it?"
"Yes," he thought. "I have made a toy. A machine. But not life." Both Mackenzie and LaForge hastened over to examine the thing, put it through its paces, held a conversation, asked it to perform simple functions, then complex functions, then more complex functions. "Oh, yes," thought Maddox. "I have done everything you have asked."
"How many of these do you have?" said LaForge.
"At the moment, this one," said Maddox. "We have four more almost complete. We can start a production line by the end of the month."
"Amazing," said Mackenzie. "Oh, this is going to make all the difference."
LaForge was standing and shaking his head.
"At last," he said, "some good news."
He grinned.
"The Admiral is going to be delighted."
"As if that would make it all worthwhile," Maddox said bitterly to Jurati. They were walking around the campus lake. It was late, dark, and cold. Winter. Maddox kicked viciously at the dead leaves on the ground. Suddenly he stopped and put his hands to his head.
"Oh, God," he said. "These damn things. This is what I'll be remembered for, isn't it? These hybrids, these half-measures, these goddamn jokes."
There was a crunch of leaves beside him. He felt her hand rest upon his arm.
"Bruce."
I know. It needs to be done, Bruce. Think of all the lives you're saving, Bruce. A greater good, Bruce. Well, you know what, Aggie? Fuck the greater good."
She withdrew her hand. "What I was going to say," she said, "was that I have complete confidence in you. Yes, this is not what you want to be doing, but it's a stepping stone, isn't it, on the way to success? The dream of fully sentient life?"
"This isn't a stepping stone, Aggie. It's a dead end." Again, she placed her hand upon his arm. She made a small, soft, wounded sound. He looked up at her. She was crying very gently.
"I believe in you," she said. "You'll do it. But you have to keep on going, Bruce. Don't give up. Don't ever give up.
You're brilliant.
In the distance, the fireworks began. The year was turning.
I think, she said, that you might be the most brilliant man alive.
Part 2. The Best, 2383 to 2384. 6.
Admiral's Log. As ordered, Captain Zotis has taken the Dignity across the neutral zone and entered Federation space. He and his guests are due to arrive on Terrassa within 3 weeks. I have already received a communication from a group of Terrassan elders who represent the population. They ask me to extend the hand of friendship to the Romulans traveling to their world and make sure that they know that they will be welcome. More importantly, these sentiments are being backed up by detailed plans. The Terrassans have asked for as much specialist help as the Federation can offer. Resettlement experts from the UFPHCR have already arrived, and Commander Bowie and my team back at Starfleet Command were able to divert 4 industrial replicators to Terrassa. I remain in awe of the skills and dedication of my procurement team, who are enabling a very rapid and positive response to this change in our mission. The reports I am receiving from Terrassa show that building is well underway, and that homes are already prepared for nearly a third of those that Zotis is taking with him. Images from Terrassa arrive daily, showing the progress of this work. It's all very encouraging after our experiences on Arnaf. Despite what my exo might say, I am not unaware of the complications arising from taking Romulan citizens across the border into Federation space. The neutral zone has been the keystone of our relationship with the Romulans for generations, ensuring peace, more or less, and providing a boundary beyond which neither party was to cross without good reason. I have not made this decision lightly. These lives were at risk. There was nowhere within the Romulan Star Empire to take them, and, after Arnath, I would not be able to trust that any world suggested would in fact be fit for habitation. A Federation world has offered these people succor. What other choice was there? Treaties can be reconstructed, renegotiated, remade. Lives, once lost, are gone for good. Nevertheless, I am glad to hear of the progress on Terrassa, not least because this means I have concrete and positive news to bring to my somewhat urgently arranged and imminent conversation with Starfleet Command.
Verity. Picard, sitting in his ready room, watched Coley as she examined the model ship on the far side of the room. The Enterprise E. His home, still, in many ways. He had been on board this ship now for the best part of 2 years and felt as if he had barely begun to unpack. Some of his more beloved effects remained in a storage facility on Earth. He should make an effort to have them sent to Verity to give his accommodations a less improvised and impermanent impression. After all, he intended to be here for the long haul.
Do you miss the Enterprise, sir?
A thorny question, one he was not entirely able to answer to his own satisfaction. He deflected. Why do you ask?
You were there a long time.
He was saved from having to come up with a response when Lieutenant Marshall signaled an incoming communication from Starfleet Command. Coley came quickly around the desk to take a seat beside him. The screen showed a split image. Bordson in his office, Clancy in a small conference room that, from the decor, Picard recognized was the Federation Council building in Paris. He felt a brief twinge of guilt, very brief, grip him. Clancy had presumably been meeting various members of the Council to discuss the ramifications of his orders to the Dignity. She looked harried and not happy. He did not envy her this task. Admiral Bordson was less easy to read, but Picard was prepared to assume this particular expression did not signify joy.
"Can you tell me, Jean-Luc," Bordson said, "what in your orders conveyed to you the impression that you had the authority to unilaterally cast aside 2 centuries of foreign policy?"
"That,"
thought Picard, was the closest he had ever heard to outright anger from Victor Bordson.
"Not to mention our treaty obligations," said Clancy.
So they were presenting a united front. Very well, he thought. He might be outnumbered 2-1, but he had right on his side. He would stand firm.
"You do understand what you have done," said Clancy.
"I understand perfectly, Captain," he said calmly. "I know both the history and the politics extremely well, often at first hand."
"Then why would you think—"
"The simple answer is that we are on a mission to save lives," he said. "We have limited time available. Given what we now know about the blast radius, a vastly increased number of people to move, and a suddenly decreased number of options as to where we can take them."
"All of which is true," said Clancy, "and all of which needed to be discussed with the Council, the President, the Romulan Ambassador, and, oh, perhaps the Commander-in-Chief of Starfleet, Admiral Bordson."
"I was given this mission," said Picard. "An unprecedented one, we agreed. The heart of the mission was to save as many lives as possible." He leaned forward, keeping his voice low but emphatic. "The greatest risk to success is that we lose sight of our goal. That is the priority, the moral imperative. Therefore, if we concern ourselves with the niceties of diplomacy or the fine print of agreements made by our respective governments in very different times, well," he shrugged, "so be it."
"The niceties of diplomacy?"
Clancy was staring at him.
"Jean-Luc, do you understand what you have done?"
"Yes. I ordered a Federation starship to cross the neutral zone from Romulan to Federation space, carrying Romulan refugees to a human colony world that welcomes them with open arms." Coley, who had been sitting quietly throughout this battle of Titans, leaned forward.
"If I might offer some thoughts here?"
Clancy, exasperated, turned to the Bajoran lieutenant.
"Perhaps we'll hear some sense."
Coley folded her hands before her on the table. Picard could not help but respect this woman, who took such care over her work, even as she was likely to be handing his superiors the means to remonstrate with him further. All he hoped was that he would not be instructed to order Captain Zotis to return to Romulan space without depositing his guests at their new home. He would not give that order.
"These are always difficult situations," said Coley. "Always fraught. This is the most complex refugee crisis I have ever encountered. On Bajor, we needed help. We needed assistance to get back on our feet, and we were prepared to accept what the Federation had to give. Across Cardassia II, after the Dominion War, what was needed was help, physical assistance."
"More in the case of Cardassia," said Bordson, who had been there. "We helped rebuild organizations from the ground up."
"But at the request of the Cardassians," Coley said. "And in each case, the home remained. The home world remained. There was some center that could be rebuilt, even if lives and more had been lost. But in this case," she held her hands out, "they cannot return home. Home will be destroyed. And there is certainly no desire to change culture, way of life, values. If anything, it makes it more precious."
"What are you saying?" said Clancy impatiently. "That Romulans should stay in Romulan space? This makes sense to me. In fact, it's what I've been saying."
"It's not that easy, Captain Clancy," said Coley. "It's never that easy. And what we have to keep at the forefront of our mind is self-determination. That has to be the key principle behind any relocation. And in this case, I believe all parties were willing. The Romulans on Sithu have made no complaint about being taken from their world."
"That has certainly not been the case for other missions," pointed out Picard.
"And no complaint," continued Coley, "at being taken into Federation space." "Sithu, as I understand it," said Clancy, "is an agricultural colony so impoverished that the infant mortality rate was among the highest across the Star Empire."
"They were glad to leave," said Picard.
but not without the permission of their government, Clancy said.
Have they sent ships to stop us? Said Picard.
Bordson said, You know they have not. We have, however, had a formal complaint from the Romulan ambassador, whom I will meet later today. Sulda is not a happy woman.
A complaint, yes, said Picard, but no action has been taken to stop the dignity. Might we then go so far as to assume that this mission is going ahead, if not with enthusiasm on the part of the Romulan government, then at least with their tacit consent?
They're probably glad to see the back of them, said Coley. Like you said, Captain Clancy, the people on Sithu are poor. The Empire sees little value in them, but can hardly leave them to die. They are a problem that can be passed on to the Federation. If we want them, we're welcome to them. A slight flush rose on her cheek, like so much rubbish. What do the residents of Tarrasa make of the plan to bring them a colony of desperate Romulans? Said Clancy. They've invited them, said Coley. They've offered their help. I'm not saying that the process won't be difficult, but the will is there.
All signs from Tarrasa are positive, said Picard. I suspect the Romulan government will try to make political capital out of this nonetheless.
From the summary dismantling of the neutral zone? Said Clancy. She gave a dry laugh. You bet they will. And all for the sake of a few 100,000 hayseeds.
If we are not prepared to throw away our diplomatic advantage for the sake of the poorest, said Picard, then it is no advantage at all.
Coley was nodding. Captain Clancy, Admiral Bordson, we are doing the right thing.
Well, said Bordson, who are we to argue with the experts, Kirsten? All right, Jean-Luc. I will defend your outrageous decision to the Federation Council with every breath in my body.
I am deeply appreciative, Admiral, Picard said.
And he meant it.
Thank you.
But don't expect them to be enthusiastic. Not least because once this colony of hayseeds is established, there will be a significant Romulan presence in Federation space, Bordson continued, not looking pleased. Issues of citizens' rights and jurisdiction alone are enough to make me break into a cold sweat. Has anyone prepared a briefing on how that might work?
Coley nodded. I have. All three of her senior officers eyed her thoughtfully.
Preparing for a rainy day, Lieutenant Coley? Said Clancy. Or have you had something like this in mind for a while, Jean-Luc?
The Admiral did not request this and knew nothing about my report. This was my own initiative, said Coley. But it might be helpful?
It will, said Bordson. Thank you, Coley.
The call ended on friendlier terms than Picard had expected. When the screens returned to the Starfleet symbol, Picard turned to Coley.
Thank you for your support, Jokan.
We are doing the right thing, sir.
Thank you also for your foresight in preparing a briefing on matters of jurisdiction.
Coley rose from her seat. For that, sir, she said, you should thank Commander Musiker.
As so often, Picard thought. As so often.
Starfleet Command, San Francisco, Earth. Ambassador Sulda was petite, elegant, and very angry. She swept into Bordson's office and refused the offer of a seat. Admiral Bordson, this is
an outrage indeed, said Bordson. And under ideal circumstances, we would maintain the treaty and territorial agreements that have kept the peace between us for so many years. But the circumstances are far from ideal, aren't they? Your whole civilization is under threat.
Sulda looked at him in shock.
Bordson, who had in recent months spent increasing amounts of time with Romulan officials, had discovered that complete frankness was by far the best way to handle them. They were simply not equipped to deal with it.
Sulda rallied. That is an overstatement, as well you know. We are well able...
I'm sure you know your domestic business much better than I, but perhaps our officers on the ground among the threatened worlds have better information than either of us.
Admiral Picard,
Sulda glowered at the name.
Whatever your private opinion of him, Jean-Luc Picard is no fool. If this was what was needed to save those Romulan lives, then this is what had to be done.
He has ordered a Federation vessel to kidnap over 100,000 Romulans, exclaimed Sulda.
Bordson sat back comfortably in his chair.
Now you are the one indulging in overstatements.
Taken hostage. No doubt demands will follow.
Ambassador, you and I both know that your military leaders are delighted to have a Romulan presence on our side of the neutral zone.
Hardly a presence. A motley bunch of farmers and their families, all at the mercy of Starfleet. I must insist that we are allowed to send a ship of our own to act as protection to them.
Bordson smiled. Allowing Romulan citizens and their Tal Shiar minders to take up residence within Federation space is one kind of folly. Allowing a warship to station itself permanently on our side of the border is another.
I must insist that these people are protected in some way. There is no threat to them. There is to their way of life.
Bordson had no doubt that as soon as these refugees could, they would become Federation citizens.
Very well. I shall make this suggestion. It would be customary for these people to receive Federation citizenship automatically within 5 years of residence. We are content to waive that.
Quite right.
Instead, they will be welcome to apply to become Federation citizens after the 5 years are up.
He watched Sulda weigh the pros and cons of all this. Her demeanor became slightly less combative.
Very well,
Sulda said at last.
But I have one last request.
Yes, said Bordson carefully.
It seems to me,
said Sulda,
that many of our problems arise from miscommunication, a lack of understanding about cultural norms.
Perhaps, said Bordson cautiously.
Then let us open more direct and immediate channels of communication.
Verity.
Cultural liaison officer? Rafi was not impressed. That's a euphemism for spy if ever there was.
They were on their way to the transporter room to welcome the latest addition to the crew.
Lieutenant Tajuth has been assigned to us, and we shall make him welcome, said Picard.
Typical micromanagement from Clancy, she muttered. You know he'll be Tal Shiar.
I would expect nothing less, Rafi.
He considered letting the comment about Clancy slide, knowing how much time Rafi spent handling queries from her office, but he could not in good conscience.
I believe this was a request from the Romulan ambassador.
Coley wasn't?
Coley is a fine crew member. You have said as much to me on many occasions.
First thing he'll do is try to hack our systems, Rafi grumbled. The hours I'll waste trying to fend all that off.
It is my hope, said Picard, that we can establish an open relationship with him.
Rafi stopped dead in her tracks.
A what?
Rafi, have you ever considered that too much time spent trying to think as a Romulan may have given you an overly suspicious cast of mind?
It's not paranoia, said Rafi, when they really are out to get you.
We have a chance here, said Picard. A Romulan officer sent to serve alongside us. I believe firmly, and all my experience bears me out on this, that hosting officers from different worlds leads to trust and increased understanding. Look at Captain Worf. I remember when he was assigned to the Enterprise. Nobody believed that a Klingon could serve Starfleet faithfully. Everyone believed that his loyalties would be fatally divided. Now he commands our flagship.
Yes, but...
Or consider Data. What we learned from him, serving alongside him, about ourselves, our humanity... Such interactions are at the heart of Starfleet's remit to seek out new life and learn from them.
Seriously, have you ever considered that insufficient time spent trying to think as a Romulan may have given you an overly credulous cast of mind?
He put his hand to his head.
I must hope, Rafi. I must hope that we may find a way through our differences.
Seriously, J.L.?
She looked at him with frank disbelief.
You're living in hope that a Tal Shiar officer sent to spy on us will learn the error of his ways from our example?